This episode is brought to you by Ursa Minor Outfitters. Folks, I'm absolutely in love with my Loon mug. It's handmade. It's an absolute piece of art. Whether it's at the office or at the house, people keep asking to check it out. If you're not a Loon fan, they also have other beautiful mugs for wildlife fans of moose, bears, and eagles. They specialize in products highlighting the outdoors and local pride through quality design by local artists. They've even started expanding into items beyond mugs, like apparel, dog accessories, and soon candles and more. They also try to partner and highlight other small businesses, and in some cases, forgo profits in lieu of charitable giving to help their community, such as the dog rescue. So check them out, ursaminoroutfitters.com, and enter promo code HIKESMIKES10 at checkout to receive 10% off your order. And for our four-legged hiking partners, they also have a portable silicone dog bowl and also a sweet over-the-collar dog bandana. Go check them out, ursaminoroutfitters.com, and don't forget to enter promo code HIKESMIKES10 at checkout to receive 10% off your order. Welcome, everyone, to a special bonus episode of the Hikes and Mikes podcast. I'm your host, Ivan, and occasionally I'll be bringing you some bonus episodes highlighting some amazing individuals who are participating in some fun outdoor events or helping some incredible nonprofits, as well as some up-and-coming outdoor companies. And in today's episode, we have a Season 2 guest making a return to the podcast. His name is Spencer, and you can find him on Instagram at JuiceOnTheTrail. We catch up with Spencer and hear about his spring and summer experiences here in the Pacific Northwest, including some epic mountaineering and rock climbing adventures, before we dive into his epic trek in Nepal to Summit Island Peak. Without further ado, let's dive into this episode featuring our guest, Spencer. Welcome, everyone, to the latest episode of the Hikes and Mikes podcast. This one's a little special because we have our first returning guest to the podcast. His name is Spencer. You know him from his great adventures here in the Pacific Northwest and mountaineering in the North Cascades, among other areas and mountain ranges. Thank you, Spencer, for coming back. You've had quite the ride since you've been on the podcast, and I'm excited for you to share your stories of what's happened since January when you were on the podcast. You know, you're based out of the Pacific Northwest, and you had an amazing trek to climb Island Peak in Nepal. But before we get all into that journey and that trek, can you share with us a little bit about how you've been, or how your spring or summer seasons have treated you?
Yeah, sure. First of all, it's nice to be back, Ivan. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed talking with you. You have a great podcast going. I'm excited to hear what it becomes in the future.
Appreciate that.
Yeah. So question about kind of how the spring and summer turned out before I went to Nepal. That was the question, correct?
Yeah. Just since the last time you were on the podcast leading up to that trip, how things have been?
Good. Busy. You know, I actually didn't get as much climbing in as I would have liked to of this year, because I was really busy working, kind of prepping for the international trip. But yeah, I mean, everything. It was a really good spring and summer. I guess I started out with a few good winter climbs and then did a couple slightly technical climbs in the summer. And I was just really good all around training for the fall.
Nice. And I feel like we were missing each other by like a week or two in certain. You were in the North Cascades like maybe a few days before I went on my backpacking trip there. And then you were in the Enchantment Summit Dragon Tail as well, like a week or two before I did the Enchantments trip. Was there any memorable climbs or hikes that you did in the spring and summer months?
Yeah, there's a few I could name. Yeah, I guess, you know, we'll start with earlier in the season. We climbed, what was that? So that'd be the west ridge of the North Twin. Am I saying that right? I always get the twins mixed up between
the North Twin Sister Summit?
Yeah. So we did that in the winter, late winter, which was a nice climb. There wasn't actually as much snow as we thought, so ended up bringing way too much gear, but it's better to be safe than sorry. So we ended up going up the West Ridge, and then we down climbed the North Face, which was awesome because it was a good 600 feet of like 60 degree slope. You know, you had to climb down with one ice axe, so that was exciting. But yeah, that was successful. I mean, that's a fairly easy climb anyways. The lack of snow kind of didn't really made it as a normal summer scramble with just a couple little detours you had to make to get around snow. But other than that, it was your average West Ridge climb, nothing too technical. And then we had some hopes of doing some hard routes on Rainier not long after that, but the early heat wave kind of took away our opportunity to attempt the Liberty Ridge. And then we were going to do the Couts Glacier, and we just had bad weather roll in when we were going to attempt it. So we just settled with the DC route, the average route, just to get a summit in, because it's all we had time for. And that was a good, successful climb.
And I feel like at least the North Twin Sister Rainier, you had some really gorgeous, beautiful, sunny days up at the summit. I know that's not always the case. I think there was one climb that you did in the North Cascades where a thunderstorm rolled in and you weren't able to make it up to the top, right?
That's correct. Yeah, this spring, actually. Yeah, we were doing just like a multi-pitch kind of triad alpine climb. And we got so close to the top. We got one pitch away, and it got to the point where it was like, you have to turn around. You know, I mean, it was just too dangerous sounding all around us.
Yeah. And, you know, the one that definitely intrigued me, because, you know, we missed each other by a week in the beautiful Enchantments. But can you share a little bit about your experience summiting Dragon Tail?
Yeah, that was fun. I kind of expected it to be easier than it turned out to be. Not that it was difficult, but I let my guard down a little bit. We took very small, minimal, lightweight axes and then micro spikes. And it turned out that the steep snow section kind of up between Kolchak and Dragon Tail, when you start heading towards Dragon Tail, was steep and almost pure ice. So getting up that and micro spikes was, you know, brought some extra adventure I didn't expect to the climb. But great climb either way. We went up the Kolchak Glacier side, I believe that's what they call it, and, you know, climbed the left of Dragon Tail and then traversed the summit and came down Asgard Pass.
Okay, so you came down Asgard Pass, but you went up a different route?
Yeah, we went up to the right, and I think that's, because that's Kolchak Peak to the right, I believe I'm saying this correctly, and that's the glacier that goes up in between them, and then you just, once you get up into the col, you kind of just head left up towards Dragon Tail instead of Kolchak.
And Spencer, was that a one-day journey, or did you split it up amongst a few days?
That was one day. We pretty much ran in and climbed it and ran out. And it took us actually about 3 hours longer than we expected, which, and it's like, I should know by now. And the Cascades, every time I'm like, oh, that'll be like 6 hours, turns out to be 12. But yeah, I think we did it in about 10 to 11 hours.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
And how was it going? Yeah, you got some amazing pictures with you and your friends that did the climb at the tip top. I've seen Dragon Tail, you know, multiple times, and I know that there's a backside route that gets you to the top that's always intrigued me, but it's always like there's not enough time if you're doing it in a day. And, you know, but I did want to ask you, Spencer, one of the hardest things for me was not actually going up Asgard Pass, but it was coming down it. And that was with no snow on the trail. How was it descending Asgard Pass with snow and ice?
Pain, you know, slippery. You know, there wasn't that much snow, and about half of it was. And then the rest kind of was just second class kind of junk. But yeah, it was slippery. But I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm used to just dealing with Cascade, you know, crumbly alpine terrain. So I didn't think much of it. So you climbed the mountain too?
Yeah, so we climbed up Asgard Pass into the Enchantment, but my permit was for Kolchak Lake only. So then we had to hike back down after exploring the Enchantments back to our camp.
Okay, so you went up over the pass, but you didn't go up to the summit of...
No, Dragon Tail. We did that. I think it's Inspiration Lake is the first tiny lake at Asgard Pass. We chilled there for a little bit, and then we went into the Enchantments. But I did see a few folks making the climb up to the summit, but yeah, it just wasn't enough time that day.
Well, it's cool you made it up there and out there. I mean, it's a beautiful area, but yeah, I believe that's the common route. Usually a lot of people take the kind of second class scramble up Asgard Pass to the summit.
Yeah. You know, the big theme of this episode is your trek to climb Island Peak. And for those listeners that haven't had a chance to listen to the Versa episode, can you share with us a little bit about how this trip kind of came about?
Yeah, well, so basically my dad, a couple years ago, him and I have been talking about doing a big international trip for a long time. he knew that I had a lot of interest in the Himalayas. So he suggested we went on a trek. And I was like, well, that's a great idea. You know, that's finally, I'd love to get out there. And then, you know, after we started planning, I was like, well, I kind of need to climb something. If I'm going to go to the other side of the world, I might as well take advantage of the time, you know? So I started kind of researching easier climbs people do to prep for Mount Everest and a couple of the other larger mountains there. And a few peaks came up and they're known as trekking peaks, which is funny because, you know, they're not easy to climb. They're big mountains, but compared to the other peaks out there, they're, you know, they're beginner mountains. So yeah, I mean, Island Peak got on my radar, and out of all the trekking peaks, I thought it sounded the coolest. I liked the location of it, and I figured it was a good way for me to start, you know, learning how to move at higher altitudes.
Yeah. And, you know, that's something that I'm curious to kind of learn about, what you did training wise leading up to that trek. Like, what was your training routine leading up to it?
I probably overtrained. I tend to do that, which is not really a bad thing, I guess. Someone that I met online shared with me a workout program that a popular American professional like guiding company uses to prepare you for Denali. So I just used that program. It was a 3-month program. There was a couple extra things a month to it. So I did a month plus a 3-month program plus a climbing over the weekends too. So it was generally 4 days a week in the gym, 4 to 5 days a week in the gym, and usually a hard day out over the weekend up in the mountains.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
And you were in Nepal for 42 days on this trek, and you saw some beautiful landscapes and country. You know, you started in Kathmandu and you made your way up, and it just changed with, you know, each village that you got to visit. Can you share a little bit about that trip and kind of just walk us through your time in Nepal?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this could be, I'll try to keep this. There's a lot to say. So it all started with, this is an important piece of information here for the rest of the story. I had a wedding back in Pennsylvania that I was supposed to be in of one of my very good friends. And I had to fly out of Kathmandu that night at 2 a.m. after the wedding. So
oh, no kidding.
We'll start the story there. I drank a little bit, you know, I was doing the visiting my friends and wedding thing. So I was having a good time. So yeah, I finished the wedding, and then we get to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to start my flying to Nepal, and about 2 a.m. And then after a few different flights, probably about 30 hours of traveling, I arrived in Kathmandu, and basically I ran myself down at the wedding. I got myself sick. The traveling and the partying and all that kind of stuff just wore my body out. So I entered Kathmandu with a really bad sinus infection. So, and I generally get those every year. So I know the symptoms, like it was happening. I knew what was happening. So, yeah, I was kind of putting up with that. And anyone that knows anything about altitude, if you go into altitude and bring a problem with you, it just gets worse the higher you go. Your body just isn't really good at recovering, you know, with less oxygen than it's used to.
Yeah.
Yeah, so basically I went into Nepal sick, and I was sick the whole time. I never really got over. Yeah.
Dang.
So that can always kind of make any trip, no matter where you're at or what you're doing, hard to enjoy, you know, not feeling mm-hmm. well. So if I say anything negative about this trip, a lot of it was because of my state of mind. It wasn't always the best. I wasn't the healthiest the whole time. So I just want to make that clear. Yeah, so I arrived in Kathmandu, and Kathmandu is insane. If you've never been in a third world country city that's really crowded, you know, you can see movies, you can hear about it, but you never know how crazy it is till you're standing in the middle of it. Like most things, you got to experience it, you know, to truly get it. Yeah, crazy exactly. City. The traffic's insane. They don't have any, you know, traffic lights, or it's just pure chaos, and everyone's used to driving, you know, 1 inch away from the next person in front of you. So if you're not used to it, it's nerve wracking. Yeah. So the city's fun, but it's a little overwhelming. And I was greatly looking forward to, you know, getting up into the high country. It was burning me out. Even the 3 days I was there was just kind of, it's just a lot, you know, a big culture shock.
Yeah. And like you were saying, you were only there for 3 days, but that wasn't where the trek started, right, Spencer? You had to do an additional flight to get to where you were going to start the trek?
Yeah. You have to fly from Kathmandu to Lukla. Lukla is considered the most dangerous airport in the world, I guess, for several reasons. It's small runway. It's very steep. You have to come in, like, the landing process on an uphill runway nestled between two mountains, and it's really short. And it's, you know, high up in the air, so the weather's always kind of messing with the quality of the landings and the takeoffs and stuff. So, yeah, you take a flight from there, which we actually, long story short, we couldn't because it was too busy. So we took a four-hour drive to a town called Ramishap and took a flight from there, which is a little closer to Lukla. But that's just kind of the alternative airport you take if a Kathmandu airport is just too busy. So that's what we ended up doing.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how was the touchdown when you flew into the world's most dangerous airport?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the whole flight was, even the airport we left from in Ramishap to head to Lukla was tiny, you know, and there's goats like all around it. Like, it's just like this, you know, it's not your obvious, your average airport that we're used to seeing in the States. But the flight was fine. It was smooth, you know, like I didn't feel in danger at all. I mean, it's obviously dangerous, but I think they like to market off of that, you know, a little bit extreme adventure tourism.
And then how many days were you there in that village before you started your trek?
We started that day. I mean, we arrived, you know, early in the morning or early afternoon, late morning. Yeah, we started that day. We were anxious. You know, you're new. It's all exciting. We were anxious. We wanted to get going. So we just started as soon as we got off the plane.
And how was it those first few days before you started making it into the Himalayas? Because it's a whole different landscape those first couple of days compared to the Himalayas. And did you do any of those picturesque bridges that go over the river that Nepal is known for?
Yeah.
It's like this.
The big hanging suspension bridges, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. Well, you do a lot of them. It's funny, you know, they're just like everything. You're new and it's all exciting, but by the time you're done with the trip, you're tired of the bridges. There's an art to walking across them, especially when there's a bunch of people on them because they like to bounce and it just like, it makes it kind of awkward.
Yeah.
But yeah, we had to.
Is there a limit?
I wondered that a bunch. And I, you know, being like a contractor and, you know, a construction worker, you know, I have the eye to look for that stuff. And everything looked solid. You know, the way they installed it looked good. Every once in a while, there would be a wooden plank over an area where a piece of metal broke, like some Indiana Jones kind of stuff. Everything else looked really good, to be honest. It looked solid. I wasn't really ever too afraid. And you have to trust it. You know, you're out there. What are you going to do?
Yeah. And how many miles were you averaging on those first couple of days?
Really, for being a backpacker, you know, a long distance backpacker, it's like the miles that we do on a trek like that are very small. They're very short. You know, you have some altitude gain you're doing, and the higher you go up, I will admit, the altitude, you know, gives you good reason to have shorter days. It just takes a lot out of you. But I mean, for me, the miles are really short. They were very easy days. We usually never did more than 6 to 8 miles max. And usually we were doing less than 6 miles a day.
And Spencer, do you know what the start of your trip, what the elevation gain or what the elevation is at that village?
Yeah. Lukla is just, it's, I think 9,000. It's right around 9,000. I can't remember exactly how much. Yeah. So you fly from Kathmandu directly, which is about 1,500 feet elevation directly to 9,000 feet, which is, you know, right there, that's a lot of gain immediately. Yeah. And then in order to get into the valley, you actually have to descend about 500 to 800 feet to get to generally where most people end their first day trek at, which is, you know, kind of down in the river valley.
And did you feel the impact of the elevation right off the bat, or was it pretty gradual since, you know, you were only doing those 5-6 miles at a time?
Yeah, I mean, you feel it. I mean, I felt it. I remember telling my dad when I got off the plane, I was like, it's already, like, the air is, you can tell the air is thinner. I remember, like, expressing that to him. I wasn't, like, gasping for air or anything. You know, I've lived in Colorado and I've been at elevation before, but that's a lot of gain to do in 15 minutes.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that I hear, Spencer, and maybe you can speak on this, that trekking up to the Himalayas is a little different from regular backpacking because of the teeth. You don't have to necessarily pack everything in like you would on a wilderness backpacking trip. How was it, you know, navigating the tea houses from village to village?
it's really easy, especially if you have a guide. You know, if you have a guide, then you don't have to, you know, you can think, you can look at whatever you want. You don't have to really think about where you're at. It's all the trails are very easy. There's little signs. Yeah. I mean, there's different ways you can go about it. There's a lot of people that in that national park specifically, you can still go without a guide. So there's a lot of people to do that. And, you know, you have the option of hiring a porter as well. So, you know, if you went without a guide and no porter, your trip would be different than my trip. I had porters carrying weight and I had a guide taking me around. So, you know, if you did the no porter, no guide thing, it would be a little bit more adventurous. You know, you'd have to carry more weight.
Yeah.
There's one thing specific, you know, I didn't necessarily need a guide. You know, I did it because my dad kind of organized the trip and he wanted a guide to explain things to us. And if I was to go mm-hmm. back, I would do it without a guide. But there's benefits to having a guide. One of the biggest reasons and benefits to having one is, well, a couple. They can tell you a bunch of information. You know, you can ask questions about the mountains and the region. They have answers and the animals and the culture. Yeah. But also, the tea houses out there, usually, especially if you're out there at the time I was, it was the busiest time of the year. And that's one of the most popular treks in the whole planet. So it gets really crowded in some of these villages. And the guides kind of make sure you have a room every single night. And I think if you didn't have a guide, that would be probably one of the larger challenges is, you know, making
sure
you
have a
bed to sleep in. And you don't have to, because otherwise, you know, you have to bring a tent and you don't want to carry a tent if you're never going to sleep.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I just feel like that was a big benefit of having a guide is they kind of took care of us in that situation.
Yeah. And, you know, I was surprised of the just diverse amount of food that they had at some of the tea houses that you stopped at. Was there one in particular that I was like, I was not expecting to have this, you know, up here at elevation in Nepal?
I mean, I think that was like my basic thought process when I got there in general, the whole menu. I was pretty impressed. You know, I was like, well, this is good living for, you know, being high up in the mountains, a dramatic area. And I think there's a lot of people that don't have, like, that's one of my biggest challenges with backpacking and climbing and like this lifestyle is I'm picky and I don't like eating the same thing, you know, so with backpacking, I get tired of dehydrated foods and just like all that kind of stuff. I mean, with this trip, one of the biggest challenges of the trip turned out being, I really had trouble after 42 days stomaching the food. And I don't want to disrespect the locals because they're used to eating that and, you know, they're just used to it. And to them, it tastes amazing. But I just had trouble eating it at some point in time. And because of that, I started to get malnourished and it made certain parts difficult.
Yeah.
But I mean, the food for someone that's not picky, there's a lot of food. And I mean, it's at the end of the day, it's still better than a dehydrated meal.
For sure. Yeah. You know, kind of getting back to the trek, Spencer, how many days would you say it was before you noticed a big change in landscape? Because it was still pretty like green and jungly for the first couple of days. But was it like a week or two after where you started noticing like, okay, there's not that much vegetation growing?
Yes. I mean, so the first week we were there, we were in the clouds the whole time.
Oh, wow.
So even as we got up into higher terrain, like obviously the trees got smaller and everything, but we weren't seeing what we were really in because so the visibility was really bad for quite a few days. So, I mean, yeah, when we were down lower, it was a lot greener and kind of more junglier. And obviously the higher you go up, the trees get smaller and it just generally starts to change with altitude. But we didn't really get a good view of anything until the day we were leaving Gokyo. And I think that was like 7-8 days into the trip. So it was a bummer. You know, I really was like kind of starting to get upset because I flew out there to see mountains. I was putting all this effort in and I couldn't see anything. And I knew they were there. But the silver lining in it was the fact that the day that it cleared up, we're in the middle, like right in the middle of them. So it was just like this big reveal of like, you know, what we were actually doing. So that was, you know, a good day to finally see where we were at and what we were doing.
Right on. Do you remember how far into the trek you were when you first spotted Everest or K2, some of the bigger mountains?
You could actually see Everest really early in the trek, but we couldn't.
Okay.
Because
of the clouds.
Yeah. But there's Namche Bazaar, which is generally the second village that you get to and you stay in. And that's a touristy kind of little village. It kind of right below where the tree line ends, but it's still a tree line. You generally go there and you acclimate. So you stay there for a day, and because it's around right under 12,000 feet. So every wow. trekker and climber goes there. That's the routine. They go there and they stay for a day and they acclimate to before they start heading up, you know, the following day. But you, and a part of the process is you climb up to an area kind of between Namche Bazaar and Kumjung, and it's called Everest View Hotel, and it's this high point. And mm-hmm. usually on a clear day, you can see Everest from there. So generally from okay. from Lukla to on day three on a clear day, you'd see Everest.
Okay. And, you know, one of the things that you did to help acclimatize is you got to visit Everest Base Camp, not just once, but twice, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Which was a bit on
that. How was it?
That's the way it turned out.
How was it getting to Everest Base Camp, and how was it, you know, making it to this magical location that, you know, I think a lot of people dream about?
It was good. You know, so before Everest Base Camp, there's a couple other, well, I guess in the specific trek in the direction I was doing, there was another high point mm-hmm. that was actually taller than Everest Base Camp. And it's when you go from Gokyo to mm-hmm. The Everest region, like you have to go over a pass called Cholo Pass. And you mm-hmm. know, we had to climb Cholo Pass, which is like around just under 18,000 feet. So yeah, and it was pretty steep. They had a bunch of snow and I forgot to pack my micro spikes into my day pack. So, you know, I did it without spikes. You know, I mean, I have experience on snow and I'm a climber, so I think that helped mm-hmm. me, but I would suggest bringing spikes for the pass. But yeah, so we do that, and then you have a couple more little villages that you take on your way to Everest Base Camp, and there's the last stop, which is Gorak Shep, and that's the last village at the end of the line, the end of the highway, you know, that ends right there at Everest. And you stay there an evening, and then a lot of people do it in several different ways. But the two areas you visit there are Everest Base Camp and a high point above it called Kalapatar. And mm-hmm. that's just a really good viewpoint to see Everest. Kind of because the lower you are in that area, you don't really see Everest because it's tucked behind some bigger mountains. But so, yeah, most people do those. And the order I did it, which was Everest Base Camp first. So, you know, we went to Everest Base Camp the day we arrived in the last village. You know, a couple miles away from it. And yeah, I mean, it was honestly, I mean, at that point, I've already been hiking for 10 days. You know, I hit 18,000 feet. Like, it wasn't challenging or anything. It was nice to go and be mm-hmm. there. But yeah, I was already kind of starting to acclimate pretty well by that point.
And, you know, you mentioned climbing that 18,000 foot pass and with no micro spikes. Where in the journey did it become a climb and not necessarily a trek? Like, how far could somebody potentially go without needing climbing gear?
I mean, you don't, the whole trek, you really don't, if you are capable. You know, there's mm-hmm. some people that shouldn't be out there, and I'm surprised that they are, and they manage yeah. to do it. And those are the people that should probably be a little bit more safe, you know, but really the island peak is the only time where I needed any type of climbing gear. The whole trek itself, the passes can get steep, but it's obvious where to go. They usually have cables to hold on to. Okay. Yeah, I mean, you don't really need climbing gear for any of the trek whatsoever.
Okay, wow.
I mean, I would suggest just maybe Renjo spikes for that pass specifically, maybe even Renjo pass, you know, depending on the time of the year. But I mean, it's still doable without them. They just make it safer and easier.
And you know, you mentioned that it was the popular season when you were visiting and making your climb. Was Everest Base Camp larger than you expected? Like, was it really like its own village up there in the mountains?
Well, when you go, okay, so there's two times to go in the Himalayas. Mm-hmm. That's pre-monsoon and post-monsoon season, which is spring and mm-hmm. fall. Summer is monsoon season. There's just too much rain and precipitation to do anything up there. So, mm-hmm. you know, the two seasons for tourism is spring and fall. And the climbing season for Everest is spring. Now, there's several reasons as to why that's the case. I can't exactly remember right now. But yeah, all the climbers are there in the spring. So in the fall, base camp, it's empty. There's no tents, you know, there's nothing. It's completely empty.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh. Now I've seen pictures and movies and read books, you know, so like I know big ever space camp can be, and you can picture it if you know like what it looks like. It's a big area, kind of right at the bottom of the Khumbu Icefall. But yeah, I mean, it's totally empty except for the famous rock, you know, the base camp rock that everyone takes pictures with. Other than that, there's nothing there.
Okay. And, you know, I got to ask you, Spencer, because this project has been, you know, years in the making. How was it seeing Island Peak for the first time?
It was exciting. It was very exciting. It was kind of a unfair scenario. The first view I got from it was heading kind of back down to rest after my first trek. And you stop at a town called Dingbo Che, a little village. And from there, you get your first good view of it. So it's the way it's positioned is there's Mount Everest, and then directly beside Mount Everest is a mountain called Lhotse, which is the fourth tallest mountain in the world. Very big mountain.
Okay.
And then right to the right of Lhotse is Island Peak. So you see, you know, Island Peak, which is a big mountain. It's about 100 feet taller than Denali. But compared to the fourth tallest mountain in the world, it looks like this little hill. So so it's like exciting to see the mountain, but from that particular view, it doesn't look that impressive. You know, it's an unfair mountain to get directly beside, you know, one of the largest mountains in the world.
Exactly. Oh man. And you know, this is just, you know, chapter one of a 5-year project that you have to climb K2. But I wonder, as you're making this trek and seeing all these beautiful mountains, did any of them kind of capture your imagination and be like, maybe I want to do that one next, or maybe I need to add that one to the bucket list if it wasn't on your radar previously?
So many. You know what? It's still, you know, this project I'm working on is open-ended. I'm learning, you know, as I go. I'm shooting from the hip kind of thing. I didn't know much. I was pretty naive when it started. And the biggest thing that taught me is that I'm still naive now as I'm going through it. You know, I have so much to learn and there's just so many things to do. So in order for me to finish this project in a timely manner, I need to focus on, you know, on specific objectives, and none of them really are in that particular area. So anything that caught my eye will just have to go on the later to-do list. But yes, there's so many kind of less popular, slightly smaller, but technical mountains out there that I'd love to come back and visit.
Right on. But you've guided us through the journey of, you know, making it up to elevation, visiting Everest Base Camp. Can you walk us through the last little bit before you actually started your climb to the summit?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot between then. You know, I would have organized the trip a lot differently if I knew then what I know now. I think a lot of people could say that about a lot of things, but you know, the way I did it, I basically returned to Namche Bazaar, which is a town at about just under 12,000 feet. That's at like kind of the beginning of where you start to head up into the bigger mountains. And I hung out there for 8 days waiting and trying to recover because I was still sick at that point, you know, and I wanted to get better for the climb. So I hung out there for 8 days waiting for my next guiding company that was going to actually take me up the mountain to arrive. So I spent a lot of time in Namche Bazaar. I got to know all the staff of my favorite restaurants and you know, the local livestock, because there was not much else to do than like walk around and just kind of, you know, eat food and read books by cows that you see every day. That was a good experience. I started to get bored and a little lonely because I was by myself and, you know, it's all foreigners. So I can't really talk to anyone. You don't realize after a week of not being able to talk to anyone knows your language, you start to get a little, you know, social. You want to be social. But the team finally arrived after about 8 days, and it was actually there was a few people that were going to climb originally and they all bailed. So it turned out to be two Canadian trekkers and just me. Mm-hmm. And the trekkers
were
going to go up to Everest, but they weren't going to climb the mountain.
Incredible. So you really had, you know, the summit to yourself in a way when you did make it up to the top of Island Peak because of just the lack of numbers in your guided company.
Yeah, it worked out really well. The company's pretty experienced company. You know, they've been around for a while, and I would have imagined that I would have been climbing with a bunch of people, but it was a pleasant surprise whenever I learned that it was just me. And I was like, well, that's great. We'll move fast. I can ask you a million questions. You know, I mean, there's a lot of benefits to just me and one Sherpa climbing.
Yeah. And You know, from what I've read and what I've seen in documentaries about climbing Everest and the Himalayas, you know, the weather there can shift, you know, from hour to hour. Was there any weather challenges that you had to endure before making the climb up?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, other than the first week or so that there was just bad visibility. But, you know, there's a reason why post-monsoon, which is generally the very end of September till November sometime, is the best weather window for trekking, I guess. You know, I mean, I know they climb Everest in the spring, so there's a reason, there's a good weather window there as well. But for trekking, the most popular time is post-monsoon, I believe. I could be wrong. It could be equal, but I was under the impression that, yeah, that like October is kind of the peak of the trekking season out there. And it's for good reason. The weather's perfect. You know, once the clouds went away, you kind of have this routine where in the morning it's blue sky and you can see, you know, the mountains really well. And by late afternoon, the clouds start kind of rolling in. You know, there's a scientific explanation for that, but I can't really explain it to you. But yeah, it was perfect weather for the rest of the trip as soon as the clouds finally went away for good.
Spencer, you've already mentioned this, but, you know, you were dealing with an illness and the trek had its hardships and challenges. I think I read that, you know, leading up to making the climb, you had a lack of appetite. You had a terrible cough because of what you were dealing with. And I think even some rib bruising, right?
Yeah, it got bad.
And then just like anything that you've been working for or working towards, I imagine the 24 hours or the night before the climb, you just don't get any sleep or you don't sleep well just because you're so excited and amped for what's about to come. How was it preparing for your climb day? And then if you could walk us through the actual climb itself.
Okay. This is a loaded question. The climb, you know, physically I was there. I was very prepared. I was ready. The climb became difficult for me due to the fact that I was sick. Yeah, I was malnourished. I didn't sleep. Basically, I came down with a chest infection. And I didn't know this because I didn't go to the doctors till after the climb. But I came down with a very bad chest infection. The rest day before the climb, I was in bed all day. My Sherpa was bringing me soup and tea. Like, I was not feeling well. It was not a good situation to be in, you know, the day before you climb a 20,000-foot mountain. I didn't feel well, so I rested all day. I drank as much tea and as water as possible. I slept a little bit that night. But I felt better the next day as we approached base camp. But at that point in time, you know, I barely slept that night. I wasn't eating well just because I was sick. The combination of being sick, being at a high altitude, and just being tired of the food made my appetite almost non-existent. You know, I was living off of like French fries and Pringles, you know, if I could even eat enough of those to get, you know, properly nourished. So we hike up to base camp. Base camp's very nice, by the way. They have a bunch of tents set up there for you and, you know, the companies kind of move throughout them. You know, you reserve them for a night or two. But we had a nice tent. So I go up there and I'm feeling a little bit better, you know, just because the day before I was feeling awful. And I'm doing my best to eat. I didn't eat much at all. And I try to go to bed early because generally you want to do an early alpine start for a climb like that. Like, we were planning to start probably around midnight, a little later, 1 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, wow.
You know, so I went to bed as early as possible, and my cough just got worse and worse and worse throughout the night, to the point where I felt bad for everyone that was camping near me, because I was the person that, I didn't sleep, you know? I mean, I literally coughed pretty hard every 30 seconds to a minute, the whole night. You know, I could not sleep no matter what. But, you know, luckily, I'm aware of how mountaineering is, and how, especially with the big stuff, the high altitude stuff, it's not good for you. It's not easy. And you have to push, you know, really hard at times when you don't feel well. So, you know, I knew, I was like, this is a good way for me to test myself. Like, I'm not in the best state of mind or physical state to do this, but I need to see if I can achieve it either way. At about 30, my Sherpa rolled over, who was sleeping and snoring all night long, which I envy. You know, rolled over and was like, "Are you okay? You've been coughing all night." And, you know, I explained to him, I was like, "I didn't sleep at all." You know, I think he could hear the fact in my voice that I was just like not feeling strong, not feeling very happy about the situation. You know, and he said to me, he was like, "Last year I had a client that climbed this and a couple other mountains who had a terrible cough the whole time." And as soon as he said that, I was like, well, it's on. You know, I mean, I knew I was kind of like, I'm definitely not going to wait now. You know, like he was pushing me, and I appreciated that. He recognized it. About 11:30, and I tried to eat breakfast, ate a little bit of oatmeal, really not much at all, you know, and was just coughing terribly. And one thing that helped me, though, with this climb and this cough is every time I stopped and rested or talked, I would cough more. So if I didn't talk and just kept climbing, I wouldn't cough as much. So that pushed me to move faster and, you know, longer than I probably should have. Yeah, we started at 11:30, and the mountain's a popular mountain. There's a lot of people at that time of the year climbing, you know, so there's probably 10 to 15 teams there getting ready to climb. And despite my, you know, my lack of energy and my sickness and everything, we summited the mountain, I think the second team out of everyone. We moved really fast. Part of it was because I had to, or I'd cough nonstop. But yeah, we climbed the mountain quickly and efficiently. And it taught me that I have the mental capacity and ability to push, you know, to keep climbing at a time where I feel like my body just shouldn't be climbing.
And Spencer, do you remember elevation base camp was at?
Yeah, base camp's pretty high. I think it's around like 16,000 feet, maybe somewhere between there and 17,000 feet.
And so then at the summit, go ahead.
Well, you already are pretty high, you know, at the base of the mountain. So, that, you know, that's why the climb's a little easier, because you're only doing so much gain, you know, like it's not from there. I think it's like probably around 3,000 to 4,000 feet from the summit. So that's not too much gain.
Okay.
Of actual.
And on the trek up there, was it just you and your Sherpa? That was your team, and everyone else, you know, had multiple people?
Well, there was me, two Sherpas, and two Canadian trekkers. So on the trekking portion, you know, when we went back up to Everest base camp and everything, I was with the two Canadian trekkers. And then they kind of meandered a different direction, started heading back down as me and my climbing Sherpa, Dejong Bu, a very good climber, by the way. He and I kind of took a detour to Island Peak ourselves for 3 or 4 days.
Nice. And, you know, I think a lot of people have seen the pictures lately of Everest, where it's just a huge line at the summit waiting for their chance to touch the summit. How was it at Island Peak? Because like you said, it's not as popular as some of the other peaks, but was there a bit of a queue to reach the summit?
Yeah, there was. It's not like the famous, you know, Mount Everest queue, summit queue. But I mean, those trekking mountains are really popular in post-monsoon, that time of the year. So they're all the base camps are full, you know, the whole season. So yeah, I mean, there are. And, you know, the whole time I was, you know, you can't help but kind of see these other climbers and they look healthy and in shape. And, you know, you're only human, you know, you compare yourself in your head. You're like, oh, that guy looks strong. Like, you know, am I as strong as him? But yeah, I mean, there were a lot of climbers, and I expected there to be more people climbing at the time that I was, but there wasn't. You know, I mean, we managed to get up just early enough to beat the line. The people that summited ahead of us, they got on the summit before the sun even came up and was back down the dangerous section before we started going up, which was a big bonus. And this particular climb, when it gets busy, if you go late, there's a 700, 800 foot section of steep cliff and ice that you have to kind of haul, you have to ascend up a rope on, and it's impossible to not kick rocks down on. So you have to dodge basketball size rocks and chunks of ice quite often if you go at the wrong time, because the route has a bunch of people queued up on it. We managed to get up and climb it with no one above us. You know, we summited the second team, and then on our way down, there was probably 6 to 8 teams coming up the wall, which was scary because, you know, you're rappelling down these frayed old fixed lines. It's busy. It's crowded. It's, you know, you're having trouble breathing. Yeah. You have your crampons on. You're trying not to kick things down on the people. You don't want to hurt someone, you know? So, you know, me being experienced, they were lucky that I was coming down on them. Inexperienced people just don't realize how dangerous it is to be above people like that with rock hazards, you know, coming down on them.
Oh, for sure. On my climb up Asgard, there was somebody that was just really bullish, trying to just grunt it out. And unfortunately, he was starting to kick rocks on everybody below him. And you just hear rock, 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 rock. You know,
You posted your summit picture already, and if people listening haven't had a chance to check out Spencer's Instagram, please do, because his pictures from the trek are just absolutely incredible. But Spencer, you actually, I think, caught sunrise, right? At the summit?
Yeah, it was perfect timing.
How was it seeing the Himalayas just light up with sunshine?
I mean, amazing. You know, it was beautiful. It was really hard. To be honest, the whole experience was very emotional for me. You know, every climb is different for everyone and different times in their life, and, you know, reasons for it to be lack of emotion or have a lot of emotion. This particular one, you know, I was carrying my best friend's ashes up there with me to release them, and I put so much effort into getting up there, and there was multiple times, you know, a week prior to the trip where I was convinced I wasn't going to climb. You know, there's just a lot, and then when I finally saw the summit, like, it kind of all hit me at once. It was very emotional. And on top of the emotions and the adrenaline, it's almost hard to be in the moment as much as you'd like to be. You know, like, I blacked out some of it. I wish I could have remembered more of it, but I know it was beautiful and I was very happy to be up there.
Yeah. It's almost like sensory overload, just because you're having so much emotions and things that you're seeing and witnessing. It's a lot.
That's exactly it. Yeah, it's true. It's just hard to take it all in and like register it all and you know, keep it as a good, accurate memory.
And, you know, I got to ask you, Spencer, because I'm always interested in people's perceptions of climbing up mountains, but how did the climb up compare to the descent down back to base camp?
Oh, man, the climb up went fast. It was the adrenaline, you know, just the fact that I was doing it, like that every step I took was getting me closer to a goal that I've worked so hard for. And then when we started coming down, and this is where a lot of people get hurt, and I understand why. You don't realize the amount of energy you put into going up because of the adrenaline. And when you start coming down, there's a level of exhaustion that you can hit that, like, you don't really experience much in life. And I, for as non-technical and not very difficult of a climb this mountain is compared to other climbs out there, I just pushed myself so hard and I was so weak that, yeah, I definitely experienced a new level of exhaustion coming down that mountain. So going up was very fast. Coming down felt like forever.
Forever. And how many days, or did you just spend another night at base camp before you made your trek back out?
It's only about a two-hour walk from base camp to the village up there, Chakong.
Oh, okay.
So luckily my Sherpa, he saw me at the worst I've been in a while. You know, I was just really beat up. I had to stop and sit on a rock and gag and cough, you know, really hard for 5 minutes, every other 5 minutes. He kind of just saw that I worked probably too hard. I did what a lot of mountaineers do. You know, you push past the limit of where you should have. So he, you know, was very understanding, and, you know, he let me rest in a tent for a little bit. I took a nap and relaxed. He tried to give me some oxygen to help my coughing, and I stubbornly turned him down and said, "Well, that would be cheating." You know, he was like, "I want that." So I was like, "Oh."
But yeah,
I learned I need to watch that about myself. I have, you know, it with high altitude mountaineering and just technical alpinism in general, you have to walk this fine line of risk, you know, risk mitigation, and like, you know, and like, there's a certain amount of risk you have to take in order to achieve these things. And, you know, you mitigate that risk through experience and good decisions. But if you want to, the line is hard to tell when you cross, you know, of risk. And with this particular climb, I knew I was okay to push myself a little bit more than normal. If I was on a more isolated and larger climb, I should have turned around. And I learned that, which is a very valuable lesson. I'm happy I got to kind of experience.
Yeah. And after the climb and you made it back down, did you get a chance to explore a little bit more? Did you hike back out?
I mean, it took a few days to hike out, but I was so, at that point in time, I was so tired of the routine, the trekking, the tea house food. You know, I mean, as much as I loved the experience, it made me realize how much I missed my country and everything we have here in the U.S., you know, and how good we actually have it. So we hiked out. It took a few days, but I had options to see some other things, but I was so tired and so sick and ready to just stop and rest that we just kind of slowly made our way down from there.
And, you know, because of the elevation gain, I was wondering, Was there any change to your gear, your pack list compared to, say, your pack list here in the North Cascades?
Not really. You know, it's like I kind of have my systems dialed in really well for anything up to about 20,000 feet, it seems. Now, the only thing that changed was I could bring a little bit more than I normally bring because we hired porters. So I was never really carrying. Another reason why this trek was fairly easy for me, the low mileage and the lack of weight, you know, being a long distance backpacker, not having to do high miles and carry a lot of weight, it, you know, makes the trip much easier all of a sudden. So yeah, I mean, I brought extra things because, you know, we hired the porters. And let me add this really quick. There's a lot of people that, you know, they get upset with the fact that porters, you know, they're not getting paid enough for what they do and what they carry. And you know, they're incredible people. They're extremely professional, very polite. Some of the strongest people I've ever met in my entire life. Patient, you know, I mean, I could just keep buttering them up. They're incredible people, but like, you can't, there's a lot of people that are like, oh, don't hire them, carry your own weight. You have to understand this. They are going to carry weight one way or another. Like that's their job. And if you don't hire them, they tend to carry more weight with supplies to the tea houses that you're staying in. So you're kind of helping them out by hiring them to carry your weight because it's a more reasonable amount of weight and they're getting a tip. I mean, I just want to make that clear to some people. Yeah. You know, it doesn't hurt to hire the porter. You're going to help them actually in certain ways. But I will agree and admit that they are underpaid and underrecognized. They are the backbone and like the reason for success for a lot of expeditions and climbs in the big mountains.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And, you know, I have to ask, because you got me into carrying this on my pack list, but did the fanny pack make it on this trek?
So you do carry pack now?
Carry it now. Because like after you told me how easy it is to just access your phone or any other things that you need quickly, it's a game changer.
Yeah, no, accessorizing with backpacking is the way to go. You just gotta, you know, personalize it, right? But no, actually, I didn't. I brought a fanny pack, but I didn't use it once.
Okay.
But, you know,
I made the trek.
The big reason was because I developed a good system right away with like the built-in waist pockets I had with my Hydrolite pack I was using. So I never really needed it. It was kind of unnecessary.
Now, we've kind of touched on this, Spencer, but this is just the start of your journey and your project. Can you share with us a little bit about your upcoming goals for 24 and beyond?
Yeah, I can. As I kind of lightly mentioned before, it's always evolving because I'm learning as I go. I mean, it's a fairly aggressive plan. So, you know, inexperience, lack of experience in the gaining of new experiences is causing the plan to change. This year, a lot of things have changed, actually. And this year is a really big year. And I will mention a few things and a reason as to why things have changed. Mainly, I got engaged this year.
Yeah, congratulations, my friend.
Thank you. You know, and I love her to death. She's amazing. She supports me in this project and, you know, and my passions and everything, which is very important for a life partner. You know, they need to be able to. You know, I drove it into her and made sure she knew that this is what I do and this is who I am. And she accepts that. And that means so much to me, the support and extra drive she gives me when I need it. But I this year, especially after kind of learning what it takes financially and, you know, mentally and emotionally, physically, all that kind of stuff to do a big trip like that internationally, I've decided this year I kind of need to be more of a husband and a stepdad. So I'm going to put more of my focus on the wedding and kind of just kind of getting our lives put back together. So yeah. I originally was planning to climb Choyu, which is an 8,000 meter peak in Tibet, which is not too far from Everest, in the fall. But basically, I would have had to get married and then not much more than a week later disappear to Tibet for 6 weeks. And it's not very nice of me to consider it. And there's just a lot of reasons as to why I'm rethinking the plan. So yeah, I'm going to push any big international climbs back to the following year. This year, I still plan on kind of keeping the project alive in a sense that I want to keep progressing every year on a decent sized scale. And I think this year we're going to do one or two technical large climbs in Alaska. I'm not sure what we may do an unguided climb, Denali. We may attempt a couple other things. I'm not sure, but I'm discussing it now with my climbing partners. And either way, I plan to come up with a plan, and it's something to challenge me and help me grow, you know, in the sense of climbing.
Well, I'm excited to see your upcoming pictures, man, because your feed is one of the most breathtaking that I follow, just because you show us sections of the North Cascades and the Cascades in general that, you know, you can only really see if you're climbing to the summit. And it's just spectacular what you've been able to share. And I look forward. Yeah. And I look forward to what comes next. And, you know, again, congratulations on getting engaged. That was it for the regular questions, Spencer. I know that you did the this or that questions the first time you came on. We've made some updates, so I'm going to ask you the new updated this or that questions and see if there's any changes to your previous responses. So the first new one is, do you prefer a steep incline or a steep decline?
I mean, it depends on the point and time of the adventure or trip, but I say overall a steep incline.
Okay. And then this one's a returning one, but waterfalls or summits? Summits all day. And then this is a new one, but switchbacks or straight up?
Straight up. Yo, straight up.
And then, trek poles or freehand?
Freehand, except for a couple small scenarios, but freehand.
Okay. And then, I know you wear specific shoes for mountaineering and climbing, but do you prefer trail runners or hiking boots for backpacking trips?
Well, for backpacking, trail runners. For a hybrid kind of hiking, climbing, a sturdier boot, like an approach shoe or an actual hiking boot.
Okay. And then this is another trail system question, but do you prefer a loop trail or an out and back trail?
I like the loops I like the loops.
Okay. And then when you come across a body of water up in the mountains or on the trail, do you touch the water even if it's just with your hand or toe, or do you stay dry?
I touch it basically only with my hand or toe.
And then this one's a tough one, but sunset hikes or sunrise hikes?
That is a tough one. I think the best, though, overall is sunrise.
Okay. And then here's the returning one, spring flowers or fall colors?
That's always a difficult one too, because I love fall so much. But the spring flowers,
especially from Pete.
Yeah, I know, right? But yeah, I'm going to have to go with spring just for this location.
Okay. And then the last one is a new one, but do you prefer national forests or state parks?
National forests.
National forests. All right. Well, that was it for the this or that question, Spencer. I think you stay true to the ones that we had back in January. You know, this is your opportunity to be able to give people shout outs and plug anybody that's helped you on the journey, as well as if folks want to follow your journey, where they can find you on social media.
Okay. Kind of like the first podcast, you know, I'd love to give a shout out to, first of all, Lisa, my future wife, for being just so supportive and understanding of my journey and just being an awesome person. And then, of course, my mom and my dad, just for being huge influences in my early years and still influences now and out creating, you know, and to who I am and what I do. I'm so grateful for that. And I'd love for you to follow my journey. It is going to be an interesting one, a roller coaster of emotions and successes and failures. You know, I like to, while I'm sharing this, I know that social media loves to kind of sugarcoat things and show you only the positive, happy side of things. But I'm doing my best to kind of show you the true reality of it as to what it's like for, you know, a normal person to try to achieve something so massive and dangerous. Yeah, I'm excited to share my journey as I attempt to achieve this project. I'd love for people to follow along. And you can do so at Goose on the Trail. That's my Instagram tag. And then, yeah, it's just Spencer Hall on Facebook. There's a lot of Spencer Halls out there, but people are hard to find me.
There you go. Yeah, I'm thankful that you shared, you know, the hardships and challenges of this journey, because a lot of the time we just see the summit or the end of the hike, but you've been able to share it. Yeah, you've been able to share a little bit of everything. And I think you're still sharing moments from that trip. So I look forward to what's coming up next. Well, thanks, Spencer. It was a joy again to have you come back on the podcast and share about this experience. I appreciate it.
Of course, Ivan. I appreciate you having me back. I always enjoy talking to you, and Maybe if I'm lucky enough, we can just beat this up every year.
Thank you once again to Spencer for coming back on the podcast. Be sure to follow him on Instagram at Juice on the Trail.
Be sure to also follow us on Instagram at Hikes and Mikes. Happy trails, everyone. This episode's music was created by Ketza. Follow him on Instagram at Ketza Music. This episode is brought to you by Flip Socks. Whether you're on the trail, on the job, or in the yard, Flip Socks will keep Mother Nature out of your boots with their innovative nylon sleeve. You no longer need to worry about any annoying debris getting trapped in your boots during your hikes. Simply flip down the nylon sleeve over any boot to prevent Mother Nature from finding its way inside, keeping your feet comfortable all day long. To get your first pair, visit flipsockswithaz.com and enter promo code HikesMikes10 at checkout to receive 10% off your order. And for listeners who use the promo code at checkout, I'll be donating 100% of the Season 2 promo code proceeds to Big City Mountaineers, who provide transformative experiences through connections to nature that strengthen life skills and build community for youth and disinvested communities across the nation. So if you're tired of bits and pieces of the trail finding its way into your hiking boots, pick up a pair of Flip Socks today with the promo code HikesMikes10 to get 10% off. For website and promo code, see the episode description.